Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Consumer Behavior. Recorded in 1995, Nobel laureates in economics Professor Roland Coase and Professor Gary Becker, both from the University of Chicago, discussed the strengths and limitations of utility theory in expanding consumer behavior and broader social phenomena. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Ronald, the theory of the firm or firms is an area you, of course, made an immense contributions. It's one of the important parts of economics, possibly another important part is the theory of the household and consumer behavior. I think we have some strong agreements on how to look at both of these type of entities and possibly some disagreement. So why don't you start and sort of elaborate on what your views are and see if I have any disagreements with
them. It's always more interesting to start with the disagreements or what I think are disagreements. Yeah. I have always been very uneasy about economists stating that they are producing a theory in which they assume that people are rational utility maximizers. The two elements that I don't like, one is the idea that they're rational, and the other thing is what they're rational about, namely maximizing utility. And I don't know whether you in your writing use this phrase, but lots of economists do. And let's start with utility. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what it even means, because you can't put a little measure into a person's brain and read off utility. And Irving Fisher had the idea of this unit utils, but right. We know there isn't such a unit.
Right.
Why can you talk about maximizing something that you can't measure?
All right, this is a good subject to start with, because I think we do disagree on this one, and so I think you hit the nail right on the head with a serious disagreement. I do believe that it's a useful, and that's all I would say, it's a useful way of looking at consumer behavior to assume that they're maximizing utility. Whether we want to call that rational or not, to me, is a secondary issue, but I do believe they are maximizing utility. It's not that I believe there is such a unit of utils that we can ever measure. To me, maximizing utility simply means the following, that consumers can order all the opportunities they have available to them, possible choices. They can order them, so they prefer some more than to others, so they can rank them. And that they have limited resources, they have limited incomes or wealth, time, whatever it may be, and that they attempt to choose that possibility, that combination of goods and so on, that is ranked the highest consistent with their limited resources. Now, I think this is a testable theory. We can test it by various implications about how they would respond to prices, income, changes in wages, whole host of other patterns. It can become a very rich theory. I think it is becoming a very rich theory. It's not an empty theory. But it does not require the assumption that everybody has some kind of utils in their head that they're calibrating, and they can figure, this gives me 10 utils and fine. Then one can do away with utils entirely, but just ask where do they prefer, they want to get more rather than less, and they want to do that in goods that they have a higher preferences for rather than others. And my claim would be, this isn't the best theory possible, but it's the best theory that we have. I don't know of any alternative that gives us the insight that this does.
You've just said that one can get rid of it. Why don't we get rid of it and just study choices? People choose, and we can study what choices they make, and we can then discuss whether they're consistent or not, which is in some ways necessary for some of the tests. My guess would be that you'd find a lot of inconsistencies in consumer behavior.
I think consistency is the test, that in fact one can show that the usual theory in terms of ranking and ordering, complete ordering of opportunities, is basically equivalent to a consistency test, that people behave consistently. Now, maybe there'd be a lot of inconsistencies, but let me sort of point out that there have been a few attempts to study the problem of consistency, not so much with individual household data, but with more group data, because one hasn't had the rich household data to do that, which is a limitation. But let's say if people looked at long-term English consumption patterns, American patterns, patterns of different groups, comparing different countries, and it's been very difficult to find dramatic, very common examples of inconsistent behavior in that type of data. Maybe, I'm sure they'll show up more commonly in individual.
You know, a lot of work has been done showing that there are anomalies in, yes, in individual behavior. I don't know about this well, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're right, in fact.
But it's mainly based on experimental evidence, not on actual choices. And I think you and I would agree that we don't necessarily have the same theory to predict how people behave in experimental situations as they would behave in market situations. Maybe they will, but I'm less persuaded by these data, and I think some of them aren't really anomalies. They're anomalies for very simple versions of consumer theory. But then almost all the anomaly literature, not all of it, but almost all the anomaly literature that refers to consumer choice is based on experiments. And I'm dubious about how well they reflect market choices.
Well, again, of course, we're in agreement. I don't particularly like these experimental results. Right. But from one's own personal experience, from knowledge of how friends, members of one's family, and so on operate, I find it very difficult to assume that their choices are either consistent or can be regarded as utility maximizing. Now, there are things where we know. If the price goes up, people will buy less. If the price goes up, people will supply more. We know things. I personally favor a study of the behavior of consumers without any presuppositions about utility maximizing. In fact, I don't need to make that assumption.
I think you would have to make it in various contexts. But you wouldn't favor the same thing for studying a firm, would you? That you should look at firm behavior without any suppositions about what firms are doing?
Oh, but the reason is to make clear, in the case of an individual, you can make having a choice between two things, one of which will make you happy and the other make you miserable. The person chooses the thing that will make him miserable. Probably also makes his family miserable. Now take a person in a firm situation. A man who buys something for $10 and sells it for $8 doesn't last very long. There's an immediate punishment that comes in within the economic system if you don't try and maximize profits and so on. So I'm very happy with the assumption that people make that the firms make profits, and you can study what firms do, and of course it fits very nicely. They drop the lines that make losses, they expand the lines that make profits, and so on. So I make this difference between people acting in the productive system and people acting as consumers. Now, there must be something also to the view that people are interested in being happy and so on. So that too will exert its influence. You know, Knight used to say that people are rational, also irrational. And that's roughly my position too. But so I make this distinction. Now, I don't deny many of the things that economists say, such as that you buy more at a lower price. I just dislike this way of looking at things, which seems to me unnecessary and I think probably misleading, but it may not be.
See, You know, there's an old saying, I guess Byron said, a sucker's born every minute of the day. The fact that people, you know, will make less wealth, sure, they'll decline. The question is how many more people like that and how dominant they are in the economy. I agree. I mean, I agree with you that profit maximization is a very useful assumption. But I don't only say that because of this type of survival argument that people will sort of be competed out. That's there. But I think it's useful in addition to that argument. I think the same thing is true on the household side. Households that make dumb choices are going to end up with less real resources and therefore be less important in the economy, although there'll be introduction of new households. But when one says, well, firms drop lines that aren't profitable, consumers drop goods that become too expensive, it's very similar. We obviously agree on this. We know a basic rule of mankind ever since we probably had any evidence is you make things too expensive, people are going to cut their consumption or stop consuming items. That's a fundamental law. The utility or choice maximization, a preference ordering maximization, so I get away from using the word utility, is simply a way of introducing those type of forces in a systematic way and enabling us to develop the theory in terrain where it may not be so obvious what are the prices and what aren't. Like, for example, probably one of your teachers, Lionel Robbins, who did this fundamental paper on labor leisure choice, maybe around 1930 or so, I don't remember when it was. He said, well, let's apply the same old consumption theory, same old utility theory to this choice, and we can gain some insights into it that I think had been somewhat missed by some of the previous literature. Now, it's true he stressed there are two forces, but that's not the issue. The issue was he was applying it in that area. If one studies addictions that I've been studying, it seems like a non-economic question if people get addicted to smoking and so on. But one can use this consumer theory to make more detailed predictions than I think you can get from just looking at behavior.
And if you take, you mentioned Lionel Robbins' article, I think it was the elasticity of demand for income in terms of effort.
Right.
Well, it make no assumption about utility. It just said that it could go either way, and he was criticizing Knight, if I remember rightly. You just proceed. I was able to accept Robbins and use it, and I think it's interesting. And if you don't know it, you ought to.
But it was based on utility theory.
It needn't have been.
Of course, ex post, one can understand things once they've been pointed out. But the fact that two things I would say about that episode. Economists, including as outstanding economists as Frank Knight and others, had been misled on the problem. Mm-hmm. As I interpret what Robbins did was, he came along and said, let's look, and this is what he does in the paper, let's look at utility theory. What does it imply about this? And it implies that there are two forces. If we increase wages, on the one hand, your time is better spent in the market than at home, so this leads you to work. On the other hand, you're richer, you want to have more leisure, and so you want to reallocate some of your time in this way. Now, that's an implication of utility theory. I stated it in language that didn't mention utility, because it can be stated, but the insight came, I think, from using utility theory. And that's why I think Robbins himself claimed that these people hadn't seen the full implications of what it means to have utility maximization. So you take it on your side, I'll take Robbins on my side. I don't have the article in front of me. And he was your teacher, you presumably know it better than I did. But I've always been impressed by that as a good application of utility theory. It's truly led to an ambiguous conclusion, which is always better to have more definite conclusions. But the ambiguous conclusion, I think, was consistent with the
ambiguous conclusion is the right one.
Right, is the right one, because over time, the rise in wages led to fewer hours of work, not more hours of work.
You get someone who was from here, Paul Douglas,
right,
who also worked on this.
Absolutely.
and did work on the supply of labor under with different wage rates involving whether they were married or wife was working. Yeah. All that, you see, I'm not opposed to such work. I like it and I enjoy it and I always have. I've never felt it necessary to have a utility theory. That's all. And there are places where it seems to me really to run so counter to one's own experience. Take George Stigler's use of utility theory in political choices. Mm-hmm. I look at the political choices that have been made during my lifetime, which have been disasters.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine describing these as utility enhancing or utility maximizing. They've been destructive.
Yeah, but I would agree with that. But that's not a contradiction of utility theory. The way I would interpret that, at least, would be to say that in the political process, you have conflicting interests. Mercantile interest. I'm quoting now the Federalist Paper number 10, mercantile interest.
You know that I wouldn't.
Yeah, agricultural interests and so on. They grow up in every society. That's what Madison went on to say and why we developed the Constitution the way it was. He didn't say that these people didn't follow the utilities. I mean, interest means something like utility, although maybe profits, but depends on which group. And the problem was that they wanted to use the power of the political process for their own interest, their own utility, at the expense of other people's utility. So yes, we get many terrible results out of the political process. But it's not that utility theory cannot understand that. I think it can understand that. A conflict among different people with different utilities. I get utility, let's say, out of something that will support academic research. Somebody else may get utility, more utility, because they're a plumber and they want restrictions on entry of plumbers. Or I'm not a smoker, so I don't mind the tax, possibly, at least for my self-interest, on smoking. Other individuals are smokers. Of course, they don't want this way to be used to raise revenue. In a recent conflict we had when the President Clinton had proposed a very large increase in the cigarette tax to finance his health bill, here you have a good example of conflicting among groups. I would say each group was maximizing their utility. The smokers were very much concerned about that because that could mean, for many smokers, since they're now really low-income people, a big chunk of their income. Other people say, well, sure, let's tax these, and we'll use that as a way of financing things that we like. So I don't think the political process indicates the weaknesses of utility theory. Indeed, I think it illustrates the strength when we recognize that there's conflict among interests.
You're talking about conflict among interests. I'm talking about the fact that people who are going to bring about policies which are going to be destructive of their supporters nonetheless get supporters, and they get often enthusiastic supporters. I lived through what has happened in Europe in the 1930s. I visited Germany. The notion that Hitler imposed his power on the German people is only very slightly true. The fact of the matter is he got enthusiastic support for policies which were going to lead to the destruction of their country. Quite apart from the fact that it's going to lead to destruction of other people and so on. But it was terrible. In my lifetime, how many millions of people have been killed as a result of wars and revolutions? 200 million? People put this sort of figure. Yeah, I don't know, maybe higher, maybe a little less, I don't know. And you've had, in country after country, the Russian Revolution itself is an example. What has happened in Britain is another example of people who adopted policies which were going to harm them. To describe these as utility maximizing seems to me to be completely wrong as description. Now, I don't mean that when you're dealing with conflicts between interest groups and so on, that you can't adopt that approach. Of course you can. And it works out fairly well there. But there's a bigger picture of the way that in my lifetime, it's been a terrible time.
I agree.
Wars, revolutions.
But that's explained by utility theory, I would say. I agree with you, it's been terrible. Utility theory doesn't mean we have nirvana. maybe terrible, the results. Let me explain. Then we take the Hitler phenomenon, one of the great tragedies, you might say, both for Germany and the rest of the world, of any time, but certainly for modern times. The way I think one would look at Hitler, and I agree with you, he was mainly popular, although he eventually maybe took a little extra power, but he was mainly popular. There are two reasons, I think, for that, both of which describes aspects of utility theory in the context of the political process. One is that he was preaching a message that appealed to people. You may not like that it was appealing to people, but it appealed to people. The greater Germany, the mistreatment of Germany under by the Allies in World War I, the unemployment that he would overcome, to restore Aryan might. Utility theory accepts what people values, whether it's good or bad, whether they're bigots or whether they're saints. That we accept that. And I think he was preaching that. And that appealed to many Germans. Number two, I think, you have to look at what the political process is. When I vote for somebody in a political process, the way I express my utility is in a very weak and indirect way, because my vote will have very little influence on the political outcome. That's well recognized, of course, in the political literature, but I think it's very crucial to understand why people may vote in what appears to be foolish ways. How does it hurt me to vote for somebody like Hitler, even though it may even have significant harms to me when my vote won't count for much? What that means is that people vote in a very uninformed fashion in the political process, because utility theory says they won't pay for them to be informed.
But that doesn't really, fit the situation. People worked hard for Hitler. They didn't just give a vote. There was a lot of active support.
Some people worked hard, but you always get elected not only with your supporters, but with the passive people in the middle who you persuade to come around to your side. He never could have won if all he had to depend upon were the people who worked hard for him. He got many educated people who weren't working for him, but decided maybe this would be worth trying. He got a lot of other people who weren't Nazis, weren't members of the Nazis' parties, but decided, well, let's give him a chance, see what he can do. He's promising all these things, the great things for Hitler. And they gave him a chance. And I think if all you have to depend upon is those people who are the enthusiasts for you, it's very hard to get elected. You need to convince people in the middle who don't have strong views one way or another that this is worth giving a chance to. And I think that's what happened, as far as, you know, I wasn't around at the time, as far as what I've read about the Hitler.
Well, I was both around at the time and in Germany. Yeah,
but would you say that's not true, that a lot of middle-of-the-roaders who didn't have strong views nevertheless went along with it?
You were hard put to find people who weren't sympathetic to Hitler in Germany.
But he only got it when in the election in the early 30s, he only got about a third of the vote. He didn't get the communists, for example, were powerful as well.
Yeah, but there were other right-wing groups,
right-wing groups.
Too.
So I don't know if you total up the whole right wing what they got, but between the communists and the socialists, they had a pretty good chunk of the vote.
There were a lot of communists, too, in Germany. In fact, a lot of the people moved over to Hitler were former communists. They used to say brown outside and red inside.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, okay.
And either group as promoting policies that are likely to make people better off.
But the main issue, I think, that you raise and is to what extent can we understand the political process as one application of utility, or is it an area which is a contradiction to the fact that people are maximizing? I look at the political process, including the mistakes made in people's votings and things they maybe, in retrospect, they're all sorry for, like communism or Nazism or even milder things, British socialism or American, Johnson Great Societyisms and the great expansion of these government spending. I think you and I would tend to agree that much of this was a big mistake. And the question is, I think the broader question is, because we see these major things that are mistakes, at least in our eyes, and maybe in retrospect in everybody's eyes, is that an evidence that utility theory wasn't operating, or is it in fact, as I would claim, indeed evidence that utility was indeed operating, because that's precisely what we would predict.
Except that they weren't maximizing it.
Well, I claim they were. You know, I claim they were maximizing, but what they were maximizing is very much altered by the fact that they are engaging in a political vote and a political contest where there's, so to speak, collective goods in the sense that my vote, I know, doesn't count. So how informed are you and I on particular political issues when we go to vote? You may be very well informed. I'll speak for myself. I don't feel I'm that well informed, but I feel it doesn't pay for me to become well informed, because what I'm going to vote isn't going to be decisive. To me, that's an application of utility theory. I'm balancing the utility I get with the cost of doing it. And therefore, it seems to me it's a supporting the argument, even though it leads to bad outcomes.
Well, I had no doubts about Hitler.
Yeah, you may at the time, and you were sure if you had a vote, you would have voted presumably against him for a communist or somebody. No, only DC.
No, but the fact of the matter is that it's perhaps just a choice of words. Mm-hmm. I don't like the notion that when people are destroying themselves of calling it utility maximization, because it just spoils. You can say, oh, well, what I mean by that is that they do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all right. They do what they want to do. But what they want to do is very destructive often of themselves and people with whom they are associated.
Yeah, but when they do that in a context where they're making a decision that's directly going to hurt or benefit them, that's one thing. Then I believe if we observe that, we would have to raise serious questions about it. If they're doing that in a context where decisions they make have virtually no influence on whether they're going to be made better or worse off, I would say the fact they often make decisions in that context that's going to make them worse off is not really speaking against utility theory, but is speaking in favor of utility theory, because they have not found it worthwhile. And this is rational. I'll use that language which you don't like. This is rational. They have not found it worthwhile to become well-informed, sufficiently well-informed, such that they are taking a decision that will be consonant with what makes them either better or worse off. That's a rational thing to do. It's rational to be ignorant, as they say, in the political process. And most people are, in fact, and I include myself in it. I'm not talking about people out there. I'm talking about me. Most of us are ignorant about the political process, at least on many issues of it. Defense. Do you know what we should spend on defense? I don't know what we should spend on defense because I haven't made the investment. It doesn't pay for me to make the investment to know whether we should spend another $10 billion or another less.
I agree on that. It must be that my experience in my lifetime of the awful things. It's been an awful time, and I don't accept the idea that people in Germany were passive. I don't know how far one should carry personal experiences, but Duncan Black and I visited Germany. We attended a Nazi rally. When the time came to show support, we didn't show support. I thought at one stage we were going to be lynched by the crowd. It was very serious, and those people didn't have to lynch us, and we were saved in the way that only happens normally in a film by the brown shirts, who, seeing a commotion, came and, when they learned what the situation was, told the people to leave us alone. But had we been Germans, of course, they wouldn't have done that. And so
Well, group influences are strong, and people get influence, particularly in rallies. That's a good example to question or to discuss. You know, is that consistent with utility maximization? That in a crowd, there was this book by this Frenchman, I forgot the name now, that impressed me a lot when I was a graduate student. Something called like the crowd or the mob or something, which stressed how much people's views altered under the influence of the enthusiasm of a crowd. I think that's perfectly consistent with utility theory. I think we have to look at the interdependences of people's utilities across each other. People are influenced by what's going on. They may be worked into a frenzy during religious service, for example. We see that all the time. They may be worked into a frenzy by Hitler, who was apparently a great orator and could whip a crowd into a frenzy where people would be unsafe, as you apparently were, if you didn't go along with the other views. Now, many people would say that's the points Ronald Coase against Gary Becker, because that's an indication that people aren't maximizing utility. I don't look at it that way. I believe, and that's been at least my direction of my research in recent years, to try to bring in these crowd and group influences on people's utilities and on their behavior, not inconsistent with utility maximization, not necessarily applying that the outcomes you get are very good, but I don't want to associate utility maximization with good outcomes, certainly in a social context, maybe terrible outcomes, but I think it's a useful way to try to organize and make some sense out of this type of behavior, which we agree is common enough.
Well, I think you can organize it and make sense out of it without using phrases which seem somehow misleading in terms of what happens. You know, when people choose outcomes which are going to make themselves miserable and their community miserable, it just seems to me not a very good phrase to use. Like, if it helped in the analysis, well, that's one thing. I think you can carry forward the analysis without using that particular word or that particular assumption.
Well, let me again try to summarize what we were discussing. We avoided the theory of the firm because we were probably in 99% agreement on that. We concentrated on whether utility maximization is a useful way of trying to understand consumer behavior. Partly, maybe it's a difference in language, but I think it's not only a difference in language. I think there's possibly a real substantive even methodological, but certainly substantive difference between us. And this comes down to the view, I think, whether one can understand certain types of behavior, such as political behavior, crowd behavior, as well as the normal behavior, in a better way by introducing the notion that people are trying to maximize utility, or that does in fact get in the way of a good analysis, and one is better off just looking at the behavior and trying to go from there and trying to organize one's thinking about the problem. I think the latter view, that one, it's unnecessary, maybe sometimes gets in the way of good analysis, and I would say it's not necessary. Of course, I agree with you on that, but I think rather than getting in the way of good analysis, it's productive of better analysis. But we'll continue this on another occasion, and thanks again for a good discussion, Ronald.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.